He looked at Almace. "But once we have our prize in hand, I will be. And then I will know which of us is right and which of us is wrong. I will know which of us serves the right master. I will know which of us is the Urizen's truest servant."
He leaned back, eyes closed.
"I will know which of us the gods have truly blessed."
The deployment bay was in tumult as Apis descended the gantry stairs. It was a pleasant sort of confusion, however. He'd always found it comforting, the sound of ammunition hoppers being loaded, of assault vehicles being readied, the crash of steel and the cursing of warriors. No, soldiers. Apis did not think of himself as a warrior. He was a soldier through and through. Discipline was his dogma, and he held it with all the fervour he could muster. Warriors looked at battle as a lover. Apis knew that it was a task to be accomplished. He watched as something that had once been a predator battle tank scuttled across the deck on jointed legs of meat and iron. Past it, he spied Lackamhew and his closest followers making for a gunship. Idly, his hand settled on his sidearm. An easy shot, even from here. One pull of the trigger, and the threat was ended. But he restrained himself. Not out of fear or worry, but respect. Amatnim wanted Lackamhew alive. It was a mistake, but it was Amatnim's to make. Apis just hoped he wouldn't be among those who paid for it. He knew that both Amatnim and the Dark Apostle thought him a fool. They thought him a pawn and unambitious. Apis was both, and content to be so. But that did not make him an idiot. Things were coming to a head between them. Lackamhew would be forced to retaliate, even if Yattle failed, or refused Amatnim's command. Amatnim was counting on it. But Apis intended to see that any such retaliation was unsuccessful. Indeed, he intended to make sure that Lackamhew never even got the chance to retaliate. Two, he wanted to check on his own followers, to make sure that they were ready for the battle to come. He continued his descent, noting the immense queues of mortal warriors waiting to file into the bellies of dropships and troop landers. Behind them waited red-daubed battle tanks and assault vehicles. Some of those in the queues were cultists. Others had been soldiers of the Astra Militarum, or Planetary Defence Forces. All now served the primordial truth. Apis watched as a Leman Russ, studded with sensors and skulls, trundled up a loading ramp, its crew singing an off-key hymn.
A sight to stir the eye, Corps, is it not, Captain?
Apis turned as a familiar voice cut through the noise. He recognised two of his men, Sapper and Gurnt, sitting on overturned ammunition drums nearby. Sapper, as always, was sharpening a combat blade, one of a half a dozen he kept on him at all times. Most were standard issue. Others were of Xenos manufacture, including one he'd taken off a Rakgol clutch master, and at least one that was demon-tainted. Sapper never drew that one. Instead, he left it to murmur incessantly in its wolf-skin sheath. Gurnt was having his head shaved by one of his slaves. Oil, made from the fruit of the strange trees that now grew in the ship's hydroponics bay, was smeared over his scalp and cheeks before a straight razor marked with ugly sigils was scraped across his flesh. Another slave carefully reassembled his bolt gun, murmuring prayers over each shell.
"Is that you, Captain?"
Gurnt called out.
"I can feel your disapproving glare from here."
"You shouldn't let a slave assemble your weapon,"
Apis said as he joined them.
"Or get close to your neck with a knife."
"Probably not,"
Gurnt said as he turned his head, and the slave carefully applied the ritual razor across his cheek and jaw, scraping away offending hairs.
"Still, you really should let him shave you, brother. He's a wonder with a razor, this one. If he had any spine, he'd make a fine killer."
He chucked the slave under the chin affectionately.
"Oh, wouldn't you, meat?"
"As my lord wills," the slave murmured haltingly.
His body was marked with brands of ownership and servitude.
Very obliging, Sapa said.
Apis frowned. Slaves never lasted long when they caught Sapa's eye. He liked to break and bend them into more aesthetically pleasing shapes for the entertainment of those who shared his enthusiasms. Whole religions had sprung up below decks, based around avoiding Sapa's notice. But he kept his foolishness off the battlefield, and that was all that mattered. Like Gernt, he was a satisfactory line soldier, capable of following orders or acting on his own initiative, depending on the circumstances. There were precious few soldiers left in the Legion these days.
"He's got that look, brother,"
Gernt said. Sapa nodded.
"Well, it has been several days since he last complained about the state of the Legion." "True. One must vent choler, lest it choke one. Remember Ulam? He choked on his choler. I thought he choked on blood. Well, he was very angry about the blood." "Are you two finished?"
Apis asked.
"For the moment."
Gernt borrowed Sabba's knife and examined his reflection in the blade.
"Satisfactory. You may go, meat."
The slave bobbed his head and hurried away. Gernt looked up at Apis.
"Come to give us our marching orders, brother?"
Apis turned and looked out across the bay, watching as several troop transports rumbled towards the assault landers. Voxcasters mounted on the hulls blared doleful droning hymns to the Lord of all things.
"We'll be accompanying a matnim to the planet's surface."
Sapa chuckled.
You did well catching his eye, brother. We will go far with him. That isn't why I did it, brother. Of course not,
Sapa said. Gernt laughed. Apis looked at them.
Our legion is dying, brothers. I told you,
Gert muttered. Sapa sighed.
Be silent. I am being serious. The Urizen has abandoned us. Corferon, Erebus, the rest of the Dark Council. They war with one another while the galaxy burns around them. The Black Legion conquers new territories. The Death Guard march in the shadow of Mortarion's wings. Even the God's damned Emperor's children seem more united now than they have ever been. And where are we? Where are the Forerunners? Those of us who saw the truth and embraced it earliest. I can't speak for Sapa, but I'm right here,
Gern said.
I'm slightly to the left of him, Sapa added.
Apis shook his head.
This is not the time for jokes, brothers. The universe is boiling in its own bile. Now is the perfect time.
Gernt rose to his feet and idly cuffed the slave, assembling his bolt gun.
You're doing it wrong. Go away.
The slave scrambled away, whimpering. Gernt began to disassemble the weapon.
Why did you come down here, Apis? Are you worried? You should be. Sapa and I are both worried, aren't we, brother? I am distinctly uneasy with the current situation,
Sapa said. He drew a knife and tossed it into the deck, puncturing the metal with ease.
But that's natural, isn't it?
Gern looked around.
The gods keep us worried, so we keep to the path they have laid out for us. It's the way of the galaxy. And what path is that?
Apis said.
Where will our path take us? Ah, there it is. He thinks we've chosen the wrong side, brother,
Gernt said.
Is that it? Should we have thrown our lot in with Lacamhu then? No,
Apis shook his head.
But Amatnim thinks he will throw in his lot with us.
Sapa laughed.
That won't happen this century.
No, Apis agreed.
That is why I'm down here. Come with me.
They looked at one another, but followed him without question as he made his way towards the waiting gunships. Some of the craft were chained to the deck, like predatory beasts. They twitched and cycled their empty weapons at anyone who drew close. Others were relatively new, their machine spirits as yet uncorrupted by exposure to the warp. Gernt leaned close.
"What are we doing, Captain?"
Apis didn't reply. He pointed towards a bulky craft studded with religious paraphernalia, its hull covered with barnacle-like sensors.
"There. The Dark Apostle's gunship. You know the pilot?" "Yes. Decimo of the Savage Tabernacle. Good pilot. Bad at everything else."
Apis nodded.
"Do you see him?"
Gernt turned, scanning the crowd of crew and warriors that moved to and fro among the launch plinths.
"There,"
he said, indicating a small group of warriors standing nearby. They broke out in raucous laughter as one of them gesticulated, obviously embellishing some tale of glories past.
"He's the one flapping his mouth."
Apis glanced at Sapper.
"Fetch him."
Sapper grinned and drew one of his blades.
"In how many pieces?"
"One, preferably. I just want to talk to him."
Sapper frowned, but loped towards the gathering. Gernt leaned close.
"I ask again, Captain, what are we doing?"
Apis smiled.
"Making sure we're on the right path."
Almace, Primus Asteroid Facilities. Lacamhue sat back in his restraint throne, his crozius across his knees. Around him, the gunship's passenger compartment rattled and shook. Thick bands of incense wafted through stultifying air, and mutant serfs scuttled along the nave, checking the weapons and war gear of the word-bearers, seated to either side of the walkway. The gunship was one of two accompanying a trio of assault landers to the mining facilities, a small army, but an army nonetheless. Every warm body that could be spared had been roused and made ready to take the facilities. Once the main facility was under control, they'd spread to the others. Each would fall in turn, until the entire belt was under Amatnem's control. Or, rather, under Lacamhue's control. He smiled. A grunt caught his attention. His bladeslave crouched nearby, glaring at nothing in particular. The creature had been agitated since its twin had died. He wondered if that was due more to the nature of the rituals used in its creation, or some lingering remnant of the man it had been. Either way, it was growing annoying. It refused to sit still, and instead paced blindly or snarled at anyone who got too close, especially Yattle. Poor, ambitious Yattle. Lacamhue could read his aide's uncertainty. Yattle had wisely said nothing, but he was smart enough to know that Lacamhue was already aware of his treachery. As was Amatnim. His hands closed about the haft of his crozius, and he frowned. He glanced around the passenger compartment of the gunship. Fewer warriors than he would have liked. Amatnim had only given him a handful of true warriors to oversee the efforts of several hundred chattels, but it would be enough. All of them were loyal to him, of course. He'd made certain of it. The only question was Yattle. And even that wasn't so much a question of if as when and how. Lacamhue closed his eyes and tried to centre himself. Meditation was another tool in the arsenal of the faithful. It helped order the mind and calm the spirit. Two things necessary for a man to successfully commune with the primordial truth. He listened as Neverborn whispered to him, just beyond the veil of consciousness. They showed him things, sometimes. Memories of a future that would never be, or predictions of a past that had never been. Lies mixed with truth, and truth leavened by lies. They scratched at the walls of his psyche, demanding entrance, pleading for aid, enticing and inviting. Little demons, most of them. Even the strongest were but minor sparks compared to the great conflagrations he'd seen summoned by Erebus. But they could be useful nonetheless. They flocked to the black radiance of his soul, knowing that he would, open the way for them, eventually. He could feel the soul heat of his brothers as the Neverborn gathered about them as well. Word-bearers collected minor demons the way a cur collected fleas. Most never even noticed the insubstantial parasites clinging to them. Matnim had none. Lacamue had often wondered why that was, why demons avoided him, seemed to fear him, even. He concluded that the gods had marked the warlord somehow, either for greatness or damnation. He wasn't sure which yet, but he knew which he preferred. He opened his eyes and found his blade slave watching him. He extended his hand, and the creature snuffled at it.
"He will pay for murdering your twin. Never fear," he murmured, "for that blasphemy and all the rest."
The bulkhead at the other end of the compartment hissed open, admitting Yattle.
"They're ignoring our requests to land," he said, as he made his way down the nave of the compartment. "I do believe that Amatnim's pet pirate overstated the welcome we would receive."
Lacamhew snorted.
"If you had to defend this world and such unrest occurred, what would be your first instinct, brother?"
"I would crush it with prejudice."
"Exactly. There are imperial fists on this world, and white scars. Neither are known for their soft feelings towards baseline meat."
Amatnim had known. Lacamhew could feel it in his water. He'd known, and sent Lacamhew to die, or to expend his strength on a useless endeavour. But Lacamhew was determined to confound those expectations. He would take the facilities and hold them. He would make use of them, perhaps even employ them somehow against Amatnim. He imagined asteroids, jostled loose from the belt, hurtling into Almace's atmosphere, and smiled. Wouldn't that be a surprise for the conquering warlord?
"Like as not, that facility is now an enemy fortress," he continued. "One we must take."
Landing klaxons whined, and Lacamhew pulled on his helm. The gunship began its descent.
"So, let us take it."
Chapter 18, 85-40-00. Almace, Primaris Grade, Cardinal World.
Calder pushed the great doors to the chambers of the astropathic choir open, ignoring the agitated clicks of the entry servitors, whose routine he'd upset. He had no more patience for such ceremonies. His mind was akin to a box, filled to overflowing, its former order given over to confusion. Had Gilliman known, when he'd sent them here, that they would discover the anchorite? Had he hoped that secret would remain hidden? Or perhaps the opposite? The Primarch's fraught relationship with the Ecclesiarchy was well known. Perhaps this was part of some greater gambit on the Lord Commander's part. Calder didn't know, and not knowing frustrated him. He was trained to see the patterns in such things, and yet this pattern defied logic. The existence of the anchorite was a secret that might well destroy the Ecclesiarchy, or, at the very least, shatter it into opposing camps, even more so than it already was. Maybe that was Gilliman's aim. He shook his head, banishing the thought even as it occurred to him. Whatever Gilliman's reasons, Calder was here now and knew the truth. His strategies would have to be adapted to compensate. If the anchorite was the enemy's goal, it gave him a point to defend, and he would do so regardless of the cost. The choir guard met him in the vestibule. There were 10 of them, clad in heavy carapace armour, ornately decorated with the images of saints and cherubs, and overflowing with purity scrolls. Each wore a thick cloak of imperial purple, and a helm wrought in the shape of an angel's face. They levelled wicked-looking power glaives as he came to a halt.
"Lower your weapons," a voice called out from deeper in the chamber. "The lieutenant is expected."
The guards stepped aside for Calder. He passed them without a backward glance. The chief astropath was waiting for him. She wore thick red robes over her frail form and a crimson cloth over her ravaged eyes. If she had a name, she had not shared it. and he had not had the inclination to ask.
A belated welcome, my lord. You have not visited us in some time.
My apologies, Calder said. Other matters have demanded my attentions. Has there been any message from the Lord Commander?
She shook her head.
It is quiet, my lord, save for an unpleasant scratching at the walls of our souls.
Her smile slipped.
That particular sound is getting louder. Before long, we will not be able to risk lowering our defences.
Nor would I ask you to do so, unless the need were great, Calder said.
If the astropathic choir was compromised, they would be cut off entirely. He looked around the chamber, taking in her assistants and servants. The room felt crowded, despite its size. The walls were decorated with murals drawn from the life of the god emperor and his sons. Gold-skinned cherubs crouched in the rafters, murmuring softly to one another. Sanctified combat servitors crouched in their sentry alcoves, watching for any signs of warp taint in the members of the choir. The chief astropath nodded.
You wish to send a final message? I cannot promise that it will reach its destination, but we will try.
Yes, a request for reinforcements. I fear we may need them. He paused. Has there been any word from Sabodan Khan or the System Defence Fleet?
None, my lord. I hear echoes occasionally of voices, of messages yet to be sent, but nothing else.
She leaned against her staff.
If they still live, they are being very quiet.
Calder nodded.
If that is the case, perhaps it is for the best.
If Sabodan still lived, he would likely be making for Almes. Neither way, he could not afford to factor the silent horseman into his strategy. An alert chimed in his ear. The vox crackled with a dozen voices. Somewhere far below, an alarm klaxon began to wail. One of the guards stepped into the chamber.
My lady, my lord, the enemy has been sighted just past the asteroid belt. We must seal these chambers in preparation for the siege. I will leave you to it, then.
Calder turned towards the door. The chief astropath gestured.
Before you go, we have heard from the astropath assigned to the mining facilities, my lord. It seems your warriors have begun preparations for the enemy's arrival. Lieutenant Karros wished to pass along his intentions to thin their numbers.
She shook her head.
I think he will have his work cut out for him myself.
Calder paused at the door.
We all will, my lady. We all will.
Almes, Primus Asteroid Facilities. The landing bay was a utilitarian space, given over to the most basic of necessities. One of a dozen on this side of the facility. Once, ships would have been entering and exiting the bay in a near constant stream. Now, ore cutters sat in their berths, awaiting launch. Karros studied the vessels. They were of a size with a gunship, but less graceful, a little more than reinforced hull bays, engine compartments and control pods. Each of these pods was inhabited by a servitor pilot, hardwired into the vessel's systems. Each also had a small array of equipment, designed to shatter debris or cut through wreckage.
The engine seals have rerouted backup power in each, to the las burners, as you requested,
Reyes said, slapping the hull of the closest. Karros glanced at her. She looked exhausted but determined. That was good. He needed them determined.
We normally use them to cut through debris, but they'll do some damage if they get close.
Karros nodded. Las burners were little more than scaled-down versions of ship-mounted lances. If enough of them were aimed in the right direction, it'd be a good impression of a lance battery.
How many?
A few hundred. The fuel cells burn out if we keep them running too hot for too long. The power you'd need to tear through an undamaged hull might get one good shot or two, depending.
She ran a hand through her hair.
Think it'll be enough?
No, but it doesn't have to be.
What we start, the orbital defences might be able to finish. And if not them, then the Capulus.
Even then, by itself, the strike cruiser would have little hope. But Karras saw no reason to say so.
And if not?
Karras looked over the ore cutters, estimating the likelihood that any of it would work. From what he'd seen of the enemy fleet, precious few of their vessels were ships of the line. Most were repurposed merchantmen or barges, carrying troops and supplies for the ground forces. Those would be their targets.
Then we will have done our duty and well.
She nodded and fell silent. Then, hesitantly,
why did you kill Galba?
The question didn't surprise him. In fact, he'd been expecting it long before now. Perhaps she'd needed the time to gather her courage.
Galba was the face of oppression, was he not? You think about what you hate about this place, and it's Galba's face you see, or saw. I made a strategic calculation designed to win you over.
He looked down at her.
Did it work?
She laughed sourly.
Yeah, they loved that bit where his neck popped.
She frowned.
You'd have killed every one of us, if we hadn't backed down right then.
It wasn't a question, but he thought it deserved an answer regardless.
Yes. My orders were to deny the facilities and their resources to the enemy. If I couldn't do it one way, I would have done it the other.
She shuddered lightly, a sick look on her face.
I told them, you know. I said you'd do it. That's why some of them have gone to ground, I think. The others are just stubborn. They think whoever wins will be open to dealing with us on more even terms.
Karras nodded.
Never underestimate the value a human being places on their life, or the lives of their kin. Whole worlds have sold themselves into slavery of one sort or another, just for the promise of protection. It is the nature of man to survive, even if that survival comes at a high cost.
You're going to hunt them down afterwards, aren't you?
She asked after a moment. He could hear the pain in her voice, the regret. Part of him felt it as well, though not for the same reasons, he suspected. For her, they were kin, friends and creshmates. For him, they were resources that were going to waste.
No, that is a task for the enforcers.
Kara smiled, trying for levity.
If any of us survive...
He could tell by her expression that it hadn't worked. He sighed. Mortals were more complicated than many of his brothers wanted to admit.
Brother!
Spyros's voice cut in over the vox. Karras waved Reyes to silence.
What is it, Spyros? Gunships! Three of them, and a handful of Assaultlanders.
Quickly, Karras blink activated the Pictorune on his display. A sensor feed of the exterior of the mining facility appeared. He cycled through the feeds, studying the approaching vessels from the various angles. The gunships were of an unfamiliar type, archaic-looking and sinister. They had been daubed in crimson paint and covered in the sort of grotesque decorations that the traitors favoured. The landers, on the other hand, were easily recognisable. Wide-bellied, slow-moving vessels that weren't normally used in void transport. Briefly, he considered ordering his own Thunderhawk to make an attack run, but decided against it. While they might be able to down one of the landers, they'd definitely alert the enemy to the Raven Guard's presence.
Status, he murmured. They've sent landing codes,
Spyros said. He sounded amused.
I assume you didn't reply. No. It seems to have made them angry. Good. Angry opponents are easier to defeat.
He watched the gunships swoop low over the facility and the landers wallow in their wake. He estimated the enemy numbers at multiples of 100. Given the nature of the vessels, most of these would be mortal troops. The word-bearers had ever relied on sacrificial lambs. That would be their undoing.
Time to get into position. Alert the others.
What is it?
Reyes asked as he cut the feed.
Are they attacking?
She sounded frightened, but did not let it show in her face. Karras was pleased.
Yes. Are your people ready to meet them?
Reyes blanched, but nodded.
We've wired the main entrances as you commanded, but left docking platforms 12 through 16 open. Think they'll go for them?
Almost certainly. I doubt they have the patience to cross the surface the way we did. They'll make for the openings we left, and trust to numbers to carry them past any defences. That has always been their way.
You've fought them before?
Often enough to know how dangerous they are, which is why we have to end this quickly, before they have a chance to change the rules of engagement.
Karos gripped her shoulder, but gently.
Have no fear, Orlodha Reyes. The ravens are with you.
Almace, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. Calder stepped down out of the grav tram. Birds hurtled skywards as he strode across the ferrocrete platform towards the waiting storm talons. The aircraft were painted in the heraldry of the white scars, and chapter serfs moved among them, readying them for takeoff. The pilots stood some distance from their craft, watching Calder approach. The faint wail of distant klaxons echoed across the city's aero ring. The ring was a belt of reinforced berths, originally the property of the city's upper classes, extending outwards from the larger landing plinths. It had been the home for a variety of private craft, all now repurposed or moved elsewhere. The White Scars pilots had made themselves hard to reach since Sabodan's departure. They had followed his orders and conducted sweeps of the surrounding area, but their commander, Torag, had refused to meet with him to discuss their part in the wider strategy. Calder had given them as much leeway as possible, recognizing their intransigence for what it was, a protest at being left behind. But the time for leeway had passed. The White Scars eyed him warily and murmured to each other in Korchin. Calder stopped at a respectful distance, aware that the serfs had ceased their labours and were watching him as well. The White Scars, like the Space Wolves and the Dark Angels, were particular about their personal honour. They were warriors first and foremost, and soldiers second. He knew that Torag in particular saw his duty as an imposition. Sabodan had provided a much-needed buffer between Calder and the wilder elements of his brotherhood. Without him, Calder was forced to impose his authority the old-fashioned way. As much as he wished that he didn't have to force the issue, he had to ensure that Torag followed his orders. That meant confronting him here, on the ground he'd claimed as his own. But better here than in the field. Torag stepped forward to meet him as he drew close. The Aquilian was a sight, even among the White Scars. His power armour was of an older mark, and he considered it a canvas upon which to enact his artistic vision. Braids of woven hair, strung from eagle feathers, hung from his shoulder plates, and his helm was decorated with another profusion of feathers, its narrow snout painted to resemble an eagle's beak. Both of his hands were bionic, the fingers tipped by golden claws.
"You are the Aquilian,"
Calder said. Torag nodded silently. Calder held out his hands, palms up, a Chigorian sign that he'd come weaponless.
"I am Calder. I would speak with you."
"Speak, then,"
Torag said after a moment.
"The enemy is at our walls."
Torag laughed, and the other White Scars laughed with him.
"Ha! We have ears, Primaris."
The way he said it, the word sounded like an insult. Calder let it pass. Torag was trying to provoke him.
"Good. Then you will have no trouble following my orders."
Torag stopped laughing. For long moments, he studied Calder.
"Then, they say you walked on Terra in the days before."
He crossed his arms and watched as chapter serfs fueled and rearmed nearby aircraft. Calder nodded.
"I did."
Another moment of silence.
What was it like?
Calder thought for a moment.
"Crowded. Even after everything."
"You remember this?"
Calder frowned.
"Some."
The process of becoming Primaris had set his mind alight. Many of his memories had become ash, burnt away to make room for new thoughts.
"Do you remember anything of Uquil?"
He stumbled over the unfamiliar name. Torag grunted.
I remember the smell of the great western sea, and the sound of gulls, the way a fish twitched as I cut open its belly.
He twitched his head.
That is all.
Calder nodded.
Good memories, though.
I have made better ones away from that place. I ride the wind now, and I gut things more deadly than any fish.
Torag paused. He reached up and removed his helm, revealing flat, scarred features. His scarred head was hairless, save for his long moustache and beard, all neatly bound. A bionic eye whirred and clicked as he looked out over the horizon. He closed his organic eye and tilted his head, as if sniffing the air. Then he leaned over and spat.
I can smell the stink of them, even here.
They have not landed yet.
Even so, they come, and the wind brings word of them.
Torag looked at Calder.
You want us to greet them?
It wasn't a question.
I want you to do what you do best.
And what will you be doing?
What we do best.
Torag grunted and ran a palm over his shaved pate.
A good plan.
He looked away.
I dreamt that an eagle circled a mountain peak 3 times and fell from the sky.
Calder stared at him, uncertain as to how he should answer. Torag smiled.
A good omen, he said.
Calder relaxed.
Was it?
No.
Torag pulled his helmet on.
We will burn them from the skies, and then you can grind what's left into the mud of this sad place. Then we will go somewhere else and do it again, until the eagle falls from the sky.
The Aquilian turned away and raised a fist. His warriors set up an ululating cheer. Calder waited, but Torag seemed to have no further interest in conversation. He looked up. The sky was clear, but only for the moment. Soon, it would be full of fire. Aemon stood in the anchorite cell, watching the dreadnought scratch runes in the wall. Though he could not hear the alarms, he knew they were sounding. The bells were ringing throughout the city, in every city. Almace's time had come, and the enemy was at the gates. Even now, those with the ability to do so were seeking safety in the reinforced shelters set deep within the city. Others were readying themselves as best they could for what was coming. Private armies assembled in the dioceses as humanity's guardians prepared the defences. It was all quite stirring in the abstract. Up close, it was nerve-wracking. A set of gilded armour awaited him in his quarters. Another heirloom passed down from parent to child through 100 generations. Today would see him finally put his martial skills to the test. A part of him was excited. Another, larger part, was fearful. Would he pass this test of his will and courage, or would he fail? Was it even up to him, or was he merely a bit player in the story of another? He looked at the anchorite, waiting to ask all of those questions. The ancient warrior had been the one constant in his life, and it seemed only fitting that he should have the answers now. He plucked at his robes, uncertain as to how to begin. As ever, the anchorite saved him the trouble.
My brothers are here, then. I can hear them knocking on the door of this world.
The anchorite continued to scratch runes into the wall. Aemon nodded.
The lieutenant estimates a few hours before they come into range of the orbital defences.
He is canny, that one. The Primarch was wise to send him.
Should we survive this, I will tell him so.
The anchorite gave a rumble of laughter.
I am sure he will appreciate your opinion on the matter.
Aemon paused, considering.
Then he said, Why are they coming for you?
The anchorite turned. He studied Aemon for a moment.
I do not know. I had assumed all knowledge of my existence would have been purged. Then perhaps they simply never stopped looking.
His frame twitched slightly.
We were sent to die, you know. Kalth. It was meant to be a grand purgation of the Legion. All those elements too mad or too disciplined to endure the coming change. I wonder sometimes if they know that. If my brothers realize that, even as they died.
Did you? Eamon asked softly.
Oh, yes. But only afterwards. I realized that Lorgard betrayed his own sons, and more than once, that Corferon and Erebus had done so as well. We were guided by traitors from the moment the God Emperor set foot on Colchis.
The anchorite studied his talons, as if seeing them for the first time.
Our legion was built on a foundation of treachery. We were very good at it, at twisting our oaths to fit our wants, at seeing our desires in the words of the gods.
He lowered his talons.
Maybe that is why they are coming. Maybe. Maybe the gods have decided to kill the last bit of truth left to the Legion, to prevent any hope of them seeing what I saw. One final treachery as the galaxy unravels.
I don't understand, Eamon said, shaking his head. Would they care?
It seemed inconceivable to him that such damned souls would do so. Once you were far enough down a false trail, it ceased being false. The anchorite turned back to the wall.
Some would. To know that we were regarded as chattel by our lords, and spent like bullets for their glory, rather than our own. We mocked other legions for such. To know that we too were but bodies for the altar, that would be too much for some, I think.
He paused, tapping the wall.
It is a funny thing. A devout man understands the possibility of damnation, but does not think that he himself will be damned. In those days, I heard my brothers boast of altars and knives. And even then, I knew that not one of them would go willingly to the stone. For such men, there is always another sacrifice, always someone weaker.
He trailed off.
But these are the words of one who has grown used to solitude. I cannot say with any clarity why they come or what their aims are. I doubt they themselves know.
They were silent for a time. Then the anchorite said,
What will you do if they breach the walls of this place, boy?
Eamon cleared his throat. What would you have me do? The anchorite turned.
Kill me. They are here for me. If I am dead, they may leave.
The words sent a chill through Eamon. He'd heard them before. Too often.
You know that they won't.
The anchorite gave a rattling, artificial sigh.
Yes.
Eamon was silent for a moment. Do you truly wish to die? The anchorite spread his arms.
Would I be imprisoned in this sarcophagus if I did not wish it? I deserve death. I am owed death.
He turned back to the wall.
But we so rarely get what we are owed in this life.
Eamon shook his head.
What will you do when they come for you?
He paused.
If they come, he amended hastily.
You mean, will I go willingly?
Eamon didn't reply. The anchorite laughed.
No, I fight them. Whatever they have become, they were once my brothers. I will not raise my hand against them.
Then they will chain you and drag you back to whatever hell world they call home.
Aemon's voice rose. Anger flooded him. The thought of such abominations bestriding the holy soil of Almace, of taking away a relic of the ecclesiarchy, was enough to burn away his fears and anxieties.
First, they must break the walls erected by the Sons of Dawn. I have faith that that will not happen. It did not happen then. It will not happen now.
And if it does...
The anchorite paused. He began to write once more.
Then the God Emperor will provide.
Chapter 19, 85-40-00 Almax, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. Apis entered the ship's meditation chamber with some hesitation. All word-bearer's vessels of appropriate size possessed such a chamber, though they often took different forms. Some resembled temples, while others were open to the void. This one was more sedate than some, fitting with its master's personality. A place of quiet contemplation and reflection. The chamber was a large, tent-like space, occupied by a mandala of semicircular benches, all centred around a single immense sensor. The sensor was suspended between the floor and ceiling by taut lengths of now rusty chain, and was tended by a quartet of blind slaves, their mouths stitched shut and smaller sensors grafted to their chests and backs. Fumes of steaming incense rose from it, filling the chamber. Prayer scrolls decorated the walls, displaying the inked leers of demons and dark saints. The statues of fallen heroes of the Legion stood sentinel at the 8 cardinal points. Apis knew some of them. Zardu Laek, Argel Tal, Zaphon, one or two others. He ignored the weight of their stony gazes as he threaded through the benches. A few of his brothers were here, stripped to their armour interface ports, as they sat in quiet contemplation. Mutant slaves doused them in blessed oils or tattooed their flesh with catechisms. Some turned to watch him as he strode towards the back of the chamber, but most knew better than to display any interest. Imatnim sat on the outermost benches, eyes closed. Mutants kneaded his muscles and cleaned his interface ports, hissing and murmuring to each other in their own debased tongue. They paused as Apis drew near. Imatnim opened his eyes.
Well, we've almost entered the asteroid belt.
Imatnim sighed.
I know. The gods whisper as much to me.
He smiled.
Can you hear them, brother?
No.
Apis glanced around. There was the vaguest impression of shapes moving in the fumes of the sensor. Neverborn, perhaps. Unaligned entities seeking a suitable husk to inhabit. That was why the mutants who were assigned to the chamber first had ritual bindings carved into their flesh. No sense letting a feral demon loose on board, if possible. Imatnim nodded.
No, I suppose not. Did Lacomhugh go in the end? Or is he slinking about, waiting for his chance to plant a blade in my back?
He went. I made certain of it.
Imatnim nodded.
You are of great comfort to me, Apis. A true brother in a legion where precious few of those remain.
He sounded almost melancholy, and Apis sighed inwardly. It was always the way. Imatnim was a soul of great merriment and great sadness in equal measure. It was no wonder that the gods loved him as they did. As if reading his mind, Imatnim said,
If the gods abandoned me, brother, what would you do?
Apis paused, seeking a trap in the words. Seeing none, he answered honestly.
I would abandon you as well. Where the gods go, a man must follow.
Imatnim nodded again.
A good answer. An honest answer.
I have no cause to lie.
Imatnim laughed. Some among us don't need cause, brother. He waved aside his slaves and indicated the bench. Sit. Something is on your mind, I can tell. Apis hesitated. He wanted to leave. He didn't care for the meditation chamber or the things he glimpsed in the fug of the censer. But he sat.
The gods truly with us.
Do you doubt them? Apis shook his head.
I merely wish to know the nature of our quest. Is it merely another campaign, or is it a crusade? Do we march in holy purpose, or merely to fulfill some objective of the Dark Council?
Imatnim was silent for a time. When he answered, he did so slowly.
The gods are manifold. They, like us, are legion. Each god has many hands, put to many wheels. That some of those hands are upon our shoulders is obvious. For corn, well, we drown a system in war and slaughter. His hounds flock to us, eager to shed blood. For Nurgle, there is the despair our presence brings, the plagues that rise in the wake of any war. For Tzeentch, look around. We stew in our own ambitions. 100 petty schemes and hopes surround us, and more are conceived or dashed asunder by our actions. And Slaanesh? Well, the Dark Prince seems to favour Ganor, whatever else.
But there's another reason, Apis pressed. The way you speak, it is as if the gods have joined together in this matter.
Imatnim smiled and leaned forward, wafting the incense about himself with a loose gesture.
They have, or so Lorgar claimed.
Lorgar? Apis said. But no one has seen him in centuries.
That is true. And yet, I did.
Imatnim's gaze became unfocused.
I went into the Desert of Bones and meditated for 40 days and nights before the black gates of the Templum Inficio. No sustenance, only unceasing prayer. And on the eve of the 41st day, I heard a child's voice, and it bade me find our lost brother. And so I did, and my quest began.
He shook his head.
I cannot say what awaits us at the end of our quest, only that it is of import to the gods. The universe drowns in a new and blessed madness, but the risen sun would build dams and dikes to hold back the seas of truth.
Why does Lorgar not sally forth to meet him?
Apis asked without thinking.
I think he will, brother, but not yet. The ground must be made ready for him.
He frowned.
Places like Almes or Pergo are cancerous nodes of deceit in the body of ultimate truth.
Anathema worlds where all but the strongest Neverborn are rendered ineffectual upon their surface, and the words of the gods sound hollow. If they are allowed to flourish unchecked, all that has been done might yet be undone. What we do here, now, might well cease their spread.
Or it might encourage it, Apis said.
The thought came unbidden, and he did not know why he spoke. Was something smiling at him from the depths of the sensor steam? He felt the pressure of the Neverborn gathering close, attentive, anticipatory. Imatnim smiled.
Yes. Either way, the gods will be pleased.
But,
Apis pressed. Imatnim laughed. A loud rumble, as of a contented predator. A soldier's laugh, not that of a priest. Apis relaxed.
But I have no doubt in my destiny, or in the gods' plans for us, brother. They have guided me and guarded me across black seas of infinity. Why then would they abandon me on such a hostile shore?
He clasped the back of Apis's head.
Fear not, brother. They are with us, and we will know victory. Now come. I would be on the bridge when we reach our goal.
Almes, Primus Asteroid Facilities.
Leave nothing alive!
Lackenhugh snarled as cultists flooded past him into the mining facility. Booby traps at the main entrances had cut their numbers, but their courage was undimmed, thanks to the word-bearers who stalked in their wake. He stepped past the entry bulkhead and into the hall, following his servants. The entry hall to the facility was larger than he'd imagined. Gantries stretched into the dark like rusty highways, gravshunts parked along their lengths, and beneath the gantries, a deeper darkness. There were lights there, far past the limits of human vision, but not that of a space marine. The lower levels, the ore processors, the thermal forges, a kingdom of industry, ripe for the taking. It was almost a shame to destroy it, but when the gods commanded, their servants could but obey.
"Bring me skulls and flensed meat," Lackenhugh continued, exhorting the pathetic creatures that swarmed about him, spilling across the unguarded gantries. "Bring me blood and souls, or offer up yours in recompense. The gods demand it!"
A ragged cheer went up, and some among the cultists began to sing. Lackenhugh tuned them out as he turned to Yattle.
"Report! We've secured 3 other entrances, losses at 32%.
Lackenhugh grunted.
"More traps! The meat is cunning. Too cunning. What about the launch bays?"
He'd sent hand-picked warriors to secure the identified bays before more ore cutters were launched. He'd seen the first wave of small vessels arrow towards the fleet, even as his gunship had touched down. He didn't know what they hoped to achieve, but he had no doubt it would serve to infuriate Amadnim. The thought pleased him immensely.
"They haven't checked in."
Yattle paused. He pointed.
"Did someone warn them about not taking the chance?"
Lackenhugh turned, even as the first gravshunt exploded, consuming a dozen men and wounding twice that many who had been standing nearby. As if that had been a signal, the other shunts blew up as well, one after the next. The darkness was as bright as day for several moments. Lackenhugh watched in silence as almost a third of the chattels he'd brought in died without firing a shot. Yattle laughed.
Well, that was amusing, if somewhat unfortunate.
Lackenhugh turned to look at him, and Yattle choked on his laughter.
Contact the fleet. We need more chaff to herd into this warren. I am not risking legion lives in this place.
Yattle nodded, and then made a quiet sound, almost an exhalation. Slowly, he toppled backwards, a stream of blood spurting from his ruined visor. Lackenhugh whirled as he heard the shot that had killed his aide. Another shot took him high in the chest, and he stumbled back into the looming shape of his remaining bladeslave. The brute caught Lackenhugh and spun, putting itself between him and the unseen sniper. A second crack, then a third followed. Another word-bearer fell from a gantry, as the survivors opened up with their bolt guns, firing in all directions. The red-armoured warriors fell back towards the entry point, abandoning the surviving mortals. An old tactic, honed in 1,000 wars, ingrained and instinctive. To press forward in unfavourable circumstances was to invite defeat. Lackenhugh heard the chatter of autoguns and the distinctive hiss of las rifles.
"Ambush,"
he muttered. Of course, he'd expected that. He hadn't expected them to have weapons that could pierce power armour, however. He pushed away from his bodyguard and lurched towards Yattle. Despite the bullet in his brain, Yattle was still alive. The meat was strong, even if the mind was in ruins. That was good. He drew his knife and winced. He glanced down at his own wound. It had sealed, trapping the bullet inside him. He'd have to dig it out later. He slammed the knife down, puncturing the seals on Yattle's armour. Swiftly, he pried away the chestplate, revealing the black carapace beneath, or what had been the carapace several 1,000 years ago. Centuries in the warp had given it the consistency of muscle tissue, and it pulsed with grey veins that spurted ichor as he sliced through them. Yattle made a sound like a groan. More shots rang out, and screams from the mortals, as they realized their benefactors were abandoning them. The others were almost at him. Bullets hissed from the dark around them, forcing them to bunch up as they withdrew. Lacomhue paid the incoming fire little heed, concentrating on the task before him. They needed reinforcements. All it would take was a little sacrifice. With a grunt, he tore one of Yattle's hearts out and spoke the six sacred words taught to him by Erebus himself. Yattle had been riven with ambition, desire, need. His soul stuff would taste sweetest to the court of the Dark Prince, and Lacomhue called out to them. He squeezed the heart, and for every drop of blood, the whispers in the back of his mind grew stronger. Smoke rose from the droplets. It smelled like incense and rotten sugar. He whispered a prayer for Yattle's soul as he consigned it to the hungry maws of the Neverborn that crouched beyond the veil. The smoke swirled about him, and he felt questing tendrils brush tenderly across his armour.
"Come," he said. "Hunt them. Take what you wish with my blessing."
Laughter greeted these words, and he heard the scrape of claws on metal. And then something else. A low pulse, hidden before now beneath the noise of the ambush. He heaved Yattle aside and saw something through the slats of the gantry. A sensor plate attached to a remote detonator. Yattle's heart slipped from his hand, and the Neverborn wailed in frustration as his concentration slipped. He rose to his feet, but slowly, too slowly. He saw the others drawing towards him, bunched together in close formation, so that they could more effectively direct covering fire. A Legion tactic. The sort of tactic their foe would predict. Not the foe he'd expected, but the real one.
"Back!" he roared. "Get back! Scatter!"
Too late. A ripple of explosions tore through the nearest gantries, filling the air with shrapnel and bodies. The explosions swamped the retreating word-bearers, obscuring them from Lacomhue's sight. He was thrown backwards by the force of the blast. His bladeslave caught him and sent him hurtling back through the entrance as the last of the explosions went off. Lacomhue lay still for long moments, trying to reorient himself. As he picked himself up, his bladeslave stepped through the smoke, its flesh and armour charred and torn. It was otherwise unharmed, and it still had its weapon. Behind it came half a dozen word-bearers, some supporting others. He looked down at his hand, stained with Yattle's blood, and heard the murmuring of the Neverborn. Having had